So we're starting the book of Deuteronomy. Many of you came when I did a course at the beginning of this year, I think, or last, on the introduction to the Old Testament. And there were five lectures there. They're all on CDs. You can get them off the web. So it would be wrong for me to go in any depth into all that again, because I've already made it available as best I can. And for those who haven't done it with me, I'm sorry. Secondly, in the book that I've published, the commentary on the book of Deuteronomy, there's a 20 or 30, I've forgotten how many pages now, introduction to that book of Deuteronomy that, as far as it gives you all I know about it, pretty exhaustively. So that's available, and you can actually read it if you want to. So what I'm offering you is a summary, and I'll only hope to spend no more than half an hour preparing you for the text, whereas I could spend 5 weeks. I don't think you want that. So I'll prepare you for the text briefly but accurately for half an hour, then we'll move straight to chapter 1, verse 1, and get into the text itself. Those responsible for the composition of the book of Deuteronomy, I'll call them the Deuteronomic school. So a tradition, like a Jesuit tradition or a Franciscan tradition, you know. Those responsible, the most probable, all of this is probability. We're talking about certainty in these matters is, it may be attainable, but it's pretty difficult. When we talk about a convergence of probabilities, that's my favourite term for it, it means that this piece of evidence points to something, that piece of evidence points to something, that points, and when a convergence of these pointers come to a, you're in, well, in science it's the same, and in everything it's the same, then that's the most probable scholarly position to hold. So the most probable position is that they were court scribes, so they're not priests. That's a key thing to say. And who writes a document and the perspective from which they're writing is always significant, clearly. So they're close to the running of the country, the organisation of the country, the king, if I could use that word. And I think, again, the most probable opinion is that they began composing this book in opposition to the political leadership in the northern kingdom of Israel. So you've got to go back into when the kingdoms were divided, and that was at the death of Solomon, you might recall. Normally they were divided. The United Kingdom was for a very brief period. In fact, David and Solomon, traditionally, the legend is, the story is that when David took over, captured Jerusalem, he united the whole of Israel, the very name itself tells you, the most significant part, and the southern tribe of Judah. But that only lasted for 70 years. His reign and the reign of his son Solomon. When Solomon died, the whole thing broke apart again. Israel became Israel, that's how they thought of themselves, and the backwater Judah down south was abandoned like a little boat off the back of the ship. But since the books that we've got are written by the Judahites, Jews, you get a southern perspective on the history, and the north looks as though it was always bad, all the kings were no good, or, you know, and it sounds like Melbourne talking about Sydney, really. And that's the way it is. So go back to David is about 1,000. Solomon dies in 930 something. The dates are a bit wobbly. So for a couple of hundred years, we're talking about the northern kingdom. So you're in the 8th century. 721, to remind you, was the collapse of Samaria and the end of the northern kingdom. So go into that 8th century, the middle 8th century, and things were going very badly faith-wise. So this group of pious, faithful, keen, trying to be honest to Yahwism, are writing Deuteronomy. Now, Deuteronomy is a Greek word. Deutero means second. Nomos means law or custom. So Deuteronomos, The word occurs only, of course, in the Greek version once. It means a copy of the law, a Mishne HaTorah. Mishne HaTorah, a copy of the Torah. Now, it's not a copy physically, but it's a reimagining, spiritual, quite beautiful, really, though imperfect, as we'll see, looking at what Yahwism really is. What is the Torah? What is the revelation? Now, was it already written down? Most of it not. That's why I'm doing this before I'm doing Exodus and Numbers. I'm doing it first because it's, as a book, it's the oldest of them, even though it's the fifth one in the canon. So, doesn't mean there were no bits written, but the book of the Exodus with the Ten Commandments and the whole Torah was not yet written. But it's there. It's people are preaching about it. People are remembering some of it. People are handing it on. It's customs, it's laws, it's ritual, it's memory, it's stories, you know, about Moses and so on. So this is a spiritual re-look at it by these people in contradiction or clash with the kings who were, and the other people with power, who were dominating the poor. And if you don't think they were, go and read Hosea, written at the same time, or Amos. And they tell you that they're current to the same period. So, these people, the authors of Deuteronomy, and I'm suggesting this to you, but it's more than a suggestion. I'm giving it as the more probable opinion. You'd have to find scholars who have a different view of it, but I think they're on the edge. Do you know what I mean? That's all I can offer you. From my reading of it, and I did read a lot about it, this is my conviction anyhow, so I'm offering you the best information I can. They were among the refugees who came to Judah in 721. So imagine the collapse of under the Assyrians, Sargon II and Sennacherib, etc. The north collapses. There's a big refugee group coming in 721 BC down to Jerusalem. It's the only place to get safe. We know now archaeologically that Jerusalem, the city, swelled enormously at this time. So there's some archaeological evidence that there was a big refugee group coming in. And where they're coming from? They're coming from the north. Well, among them, I'm suggesting to you, are the Deuteronomists. And they found an ally there in the king in the south at that time, King Hezekiah. Unfortunately, King Hezekiah's dates are wobbly, because if you read the Bible itself, and some of it has him already king in 721, others have him becoming king in 716, if you follow that. So the Bible doesn't get all the facts all the time right, and no doubt there were two opinions on it 400 years later. Do you get me? Or not 400, 250 years later. So they put both in, because one of them might be right. But they weren't sure. So we're not sure. But King Hezekiah was of significant, and he favoured, because he didn't want to happen in the south what happened in the north. You're following my logic? So these people said, well, look, the problem in the north was they failed to follow Yahwism properly. And this is what it means. And he thought, this is great. It's a new spiritual revival, a new evangelism, you know, kind of thing. So however, when he died, his son, who reigned from 687 to 642, so that's a pretty long reign, that's 45 years, Manasseh. Now Manasseh gets a bad press. Poor Manasseh. Manasseh was stuck in Judah, and the Assyrians were more and more powerful. Either you get swamped, or you get obliterated, or you become the Vichy French during the war with Germany, you know. What do? Do you have the whole country ruined, or do you compromise? I mean, there are different opinions on this, of course, historically, but I don't feel ready to say the people who somehow thought to hold on to something, and when France collapsed so quickly, and kind of didn't side with, but do you know what I mean? It's a difficult position to be in. Manasseh paid a tribute and put a statue of Ashur in the temple and did all this, and the religion kind of collapsed at his time. Maybe he lacked courage, maybe he was more prudent than the rabid people around him. I don't have to judge him. All I know is I'm suggesting that the Deuteronomic school had to go underground. because it was no longer politically favourable. However, when Josiah became king in 640 to 609, so we're leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem period, and I've done this with it, they played a significant role in that. And the reforms of Josiah and what we're going to see in Deuteronomy are very close. They're obviously related. Which comes first, why it comes first, they're a bit difficult to tell. And this group continued during and after the Babylonian exile. So what have I left you with? I think I've left you with an idea of who's writing this. And the final document we're going to look at is exilic or post-exilic. So we're into the 6th century BC. But its origins come from the Northern Kingdom and from two attempts in the Judah under Hezekiah and then under Josiah, the two kings that get a good press in the Deuteronomic writings, because that's what the history comes from. So they favoured these two for obvious enough reasons. They were significant there, and they're the authors. Let's move on then to a man called Walter Brueggemann. Writes a lot. Always writes well. And he's not Catholic, I know that. I've forgotten exactly, I should know, but it doesn't escape what he is. But he's a good scholar and a popularizer scholar too. So it's always worth a read because you can understand what he's saying. Whereas, understandably, most scholars you can't, unless you're a scholar yourself. It's like people who write directions for the running of a lawnmower. I mean, yeah, you have to be an architect to read them, or a cookery. You know, it's hard to speak and connect with ordinary people in highly, you know, doesn't it? So he writes this, and this is a common opinion. Because Deuteronomy as a book reached its final form through a long editorial process, I've given you that briefly, designed to keep the book pertinent and responsive to different historical crises. That's critical stuff. And I'm helping you understand how to read the Bible, I hope. So what they wrote when they were in the Northern Kingdom is one thing. When they come south and the problems are different, can't you see their reshaping it, and then they go underground for a while and think about it in the light of what's happening during Manasseh. Then Josiah comes and there's an opportunity because the Assyrians have withdrawn. That's why they did. The Assyrians were busy fighting the Babylonians, so it left a bit of space. So Josiah, they came forward, and so all that's happened. Then the exile comes and the destruction of Jerusalem, and they're constantly revisiting this text, reimagining it, representing it, reconnecting with the people about what it really means to be a follower of Moses, just as we continually revisit the catechism. And so we should. It's not easy, says Brueggemann, to date the book or identify its origins. It's not easy to do it, and here am I, just a minute ago, I did it. So aren't I brash? No. It isn't easy to do, and it's not easy to do with certainty, but there are indications, which he himself agrees with. That's why. So let's look at part one of the book, which is our topic for this morning, chapter 1 to chapter 4. We're poised to enter the promised land looking back and looking forward. That's what the book's doing. The whole book is Moses' last will and testament. It's not, of course, but that's how it's presented. They've gone back to see what was Moses really about. What would Moses want to have said to the people as he died? What did he want a hand on? You follow all that? What was his spirit? What was his key insights? What was this all about? And that's what they do with this. That's the whole book, is Moses telling them. Well, Moses is the spokesperson, the key character on stage, and he's doing it. But he's looking back to where they've been and looking forward to the promised land. So you've got to locate it right on the edge of the Jordan River. Brueggemann concludes, same author, page 19, that the Moses' first, inverted commas, speech, it's his speech, but it's like a speech of Richard III in Shakespeare. You know, he's not quoting Richard III, but he's... Or some of the speeches of Jesus in John's Gospel. Long speeches. They're John's writing. But Jesus, he's taking us to the heart of what Jesus meant, said, believed, handed on. Do you get it? So, Moses, it was written to, quote, serve the needs of the exilic community in the 6th century after Jerusalem had been lost and the opinion makers in the community were deported out of the land. And he continues, scholars inclined to regard chapters 1 to 3 and later chapters, we'll do later, 29 to 32, as a literary theological introduction to the entire corpus body of the Deuteronomic history in its final form, which includes the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. In other words, they're suggesting, that's what he says, this is what scholars are inclined to think, and all the evidence I've studied makes me inclined to think too, that the book itself starts in chapter 4, Deuteronomy, and we'll see that this morning. That's where the book started. But when Deuteronomy was finished, the book itself, and in exile they'd written the book of Joshua about the entrance into the promised land, then the book of Judges about the time of the tribal area, then the book, two books of Samuel and the two books of Kings, and they brought it right down to the destruction of Jerusalem, you get it? Brought it right up to the moment. When that was finished, chapters, they're suggesting that chapter 1 to 3 was put on as an introduction to the whole lot, the whole of this Deuteronomic material. So, the Deuteronomic school highlights two major themes, looking back and looking forward. Now let's look back. They focus on the main sin that brought about the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile. That's what they're concerned with as they now reimagine it in exile. They've reimagined it a few times, but now Jerusalem is destroyed. They're in exile. Why? What's the key? Where did we go wrong? Just like the Jews asked, didn't they? The Shoah, the Holocaust. Where did we go wrong? What were we doing that God would allow this to happen? That kind of question, which is not such a good one, I don't think, but a natural one almost. So they're asking that too. And they discovered, this is what they came up with, the fact that it's infidelity to the special covenant they have with Yahweh. Pretty obvious answer, but we were unfaithful to the beautiful covenant, this wonderful God Yahweh has with us. Because we're unfaithful, we lost the plot and we lost our heritage. We threw away the gifts that God had given us. They do so. How do they do this? How do they make this point? By the way they draw on traditional stories. They're not inventing them. There's traditional stories that have come down 500 years about rock and water and desert journey and manna and, you know. So they've come through the stories that have got, well, they're lost in history, but they're the stories. And they draw on these traditional stories to reconstruct the wilderness journey. So the 40 years, this is all what this is about, this looking back bit, the 40 years of journeying through the desert, and Moses is at the end of that 40 years speaking, so he's looking back. All of that is a reconstruction. None of it is history. None of it is fact, I mean. None of it is memory, accurate memory. It's stories that would have some relevance to what happened. We're not denying anything that happened, but we don't know exactly what happened. What? Because they are writing the story. Why? In such a way as to connect the experience of their ancestors with that of the exiles, who are, by the way, going to begin a journey back to the promised land. Do you see the relevance? Mm-hmm. They're about to journey across the desert to Jerusalem. So how are we going to do it? Let's not do it the way our ancestors did it. Let's not do what they did. So they paint the picture of their ancestor facing the same problems that they're facing. And no doubt they did. Every human life faces much the same problems. So it's not a novel, but it's a powerful insight into human behaviour that's relevant to the readers. They're poised to cross over and enter the promised land. Can you follow what I'm... Are you still with me? I'm trying to get you to hold a lot of marbles in the air before I begin to get the feel of it all, because otherwise, how can you read it? The exiles in Babylon must listen carefully to Moses' words, for the lessons he teaches are the lessons they need to learn. So put yourself in exile, sit by the waters of Babylon, imagine yourself there, and read the book of Deuteronomy, and you're going fine. You're in exactly the right place to read it. Because they've got to learn, we've got to learn, I've got to learn the lessons here. Keep in mind, however, that the lessons that are being taught by the authors of the book of Deuteronomy did not know Jesus, did not experience the final revelation. So the tradition that they're handing on is the best prayerful insights they've got, but are necessarily imperfect. When their ancestors believed in Yahweh's purposes for them and in his power to achieve them, so the story is told, they met with success. This is a little bit tricky, this part of Deuteronomy. It's success theology. If you do God's will, you'll be well, fine, you'll live forever, your family will be burgeoning, everything will be fantastic. If you don't do God's will, you'll get crucified, you'll make a mess of things, your family will go down the drain and you'll die young. That's basically what they're telling people. Well, wouldn't you want to live a good, full life and have your family happy and do everything like that? So, you know what to do. Do what God said. In the light of the crucifixion of Jesus, can you see where that's a bit of a problem? Boom! Suddenly, you've got this hitting you. No wonder the New Testament people had to rethink everything. No wonder Paul had to go for 3 years into the deserts of Arabia to make sense of all this. So, because it's not just simple. But yet, we, if you're not careful, we can hold, and there are plenty of possibly millions of Christians in the world who take all of this literally, all of it is equally true, and they seem to have the ability to hold the book of Deuteronomy and the Beatitudes in the one head, not connected. The dots aren't joined. Otherwise, they'd have to say, oh, you can't touch lepers. Jesus touches the leper. Oh. But they don't ask do you know what I mean? We're going to watch all this and try and bring our brain to church with us, or even to Yarralumla. When they failed to believe, but chose to rely on themselves, so the story tells us, they met with failure. There's a lot of truth in that. That's why they spent the long years wandering in the wilderness, not learning the lessons they needed to learn. So they actually all died out. And it was their kids that got the message and entered the promised land. Next book, and made a mess of it. The exiles are where they are for the same reason as in exile, in the desert, you get it? For the same reason that Moses and his community were in the desert. It's because we didn't trust, we didn't believe, we didn't do what God said, we didn't obey the Torah, etc. That's, in a way, in a nutshell, what they're saying. Looking forward, which they're also doing here in this introductory section, they focus on Yahweh's promise to give them the promised land, because God's promises are always kept. This is a key insight that we all still have. Jesus was full of this. Even on the cross, Jesus believed that God's promises to him were intact. So he could say, why have you abandoned me? Because he felt abandoned, he was real. But he could put at the front, my God. You know, so in other words, I don't understand why I feel so abandoned, but I still trust you. And then he can go on to say, into your hands I commit my spirit. So, because God's promises are always kept, it's up to us to welcome them. If we don't, they don't happen. They're not pushed onto us. Pull down the blind, the sun doesn't get in. But the sun is always shining. All we've got to do is lift the blind for the sun to shine in. That's a key insight of Christianity and Judaism and any sensible person. But we didn't always learn that when we were young, and we didn't learn it too well, some of us. So we kind of doubt God's... And even we were taught that God punishes and sin and God will send you to hell. Were you ever taught that? Well, the latest catechism, thank God, doesn't say that. It says hell is a self-inflicted, self-chosen position of pride. It's not where God sends you. It's where you go when you reject God. So if you're outside the home, it's not that mum and dad kicked you out. It's that you walked out, slammed the door, and threw away the telephone number. That's why you're where you are. Mum and dad are still weeping, loving, welcoming, ready, and the rest of it. Do you get it? So, the Deuteronomists want their contemporaries to listen to Moses, for their future depends on it. I hope you can do this. Put yourself in two places. Put yourself in Moab with Moses and the people about to cross over to the Promised Land. That's where you'll be overtly. That's the metaphor. But the reality is you're in exile, wondering whether you'll go back to Judah or stay in exile and start Rothschild's bank and become a billionaire and have a yacht on the Mediterranean and give your faith away. They're your choices. So, or you're who we are. In a post-Vatican church that's not willing to trust Vatican II enough. These basic lessons of trust and obedience each new generation has to learn for itself. And if they don't do it, history will continue to repeat itself. That's the end of my introduction, and now you get chapter 1. Are you ready? Into the text. If you want more, you've got a whole pile of stuff I've already written for you available. Chapter 1, verses 5 to 6 and verse 8. I'll obviously have to select. I can't do the whole text. Beyond the Jordan in the land of Moab... I'll give you a map in a minute, but just Jordan. Moses undertook to expound this law as follows. And the word used for law in the book of Deuteronomy is Torah. And in not always in the others, in the priestly documents it doesn't, but in the Deuteronomy school, Torah always means the whole of God's revelation. The lot, not just the five books of the Pentateuch. So it includes the prophets and the whole tradition. And this is how Moses expounded it. Yahweh our God spoke to us at Horeb. All through the Deuteronomic works, including the histories, Joshua, Judah, they don't use the word Sinai. They use the word Horeb. Horeb means wilderness mountain. They don't name it. They don't name it as Sinai. But it's the reference is to the same place, of course. But they probably didn't know where the place was, and we don't know where the place was either, so don't blame them. But wherever it was, this is the mountain, the metaphorical mountain, perhaps, like the mountain of Beatitudes, the mountain of Transfiguration, the mountain of Galilee. So mountain has got a lot of... atavistic, I don't know if that's the right word, but hasn't it? It's a really basic symbol for us all going up onto the mountain in prayer. So this is the mountain, and Horeb just means the mountain in the wilderness. Arab, Araba is wilderness. Horeb is the mountain. Har, you get it? The mountain of the wilderness. So he said this, see, I have, this is Yahweh, how God spoke to us and said, see, I've set the land before you. Go in, take possession of the land that I swore to your ancestors, to Abram, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give to them and their descendants after them. All of that, those stories are in the book of Genesis, aren't they? Abram, as you can read those elsewhere, but this is the tradition. Deuteronomy 1, verses 9 to 18, talks about the administration of justice organized before leaving Horeb. So it's looking back. So we're here on the edge of the Jordan River, wondering what's going to happen when we cross over. So it's D-Day, and we're about to get it, go across. And Moses, that is, the authors of the Deuteronomy, are going right back to, I'll call it Sinai, just not to confuse you, okay, the Sinai Desert. And this is how the organization was before they set out on their journey 40 years ago, a generation ago. Choose, this is chapter 1, verse 9 to 18, choose for each of your tribes individuals who are wise, discerning, and reputable to be your leaders. Okay? I'm the next Archbishop of you probably don't know that yet. So I'm the next Archbishop of Canberra, and I write to you people who are in that great big parish at the south, which our dear brother is running for us. His mother's there looking at me as if to say, how does he do it? I don't know. And he's got, you know, John Armstrong. And I write to each of the parishes and say, okay, we're going to stop all this. We're tired of it. It's a bit, they're all wearing themselves out. And you're not getting the proper service of people because you can't with all this. So I write to you. Choose individuals who are wise, discerning, and reputable to be your leaders. Could you do it? Oh, come to Kippax. I could give you half a dozen. We've got spare wheels galore. So in other words, do what Paul did when he went around his journeys and he said to the Philippians, look, choose a leader. Or he saw them and chose them. Who does the choosing? But, you know, find someone to lead your community and so on. But that's what he's saying to him. I charged your judges at that time, says Moses, you know, at the beginning. Give the members of your community a fair hearing. Judge rightly between one person and another, whether citizen or resident alien. So this is pretty all-embracing, really. You must not be partial in judging. Real Yahwism, this is. Don't favour the rich. Don't favour the powerful. Don't favour the ones who present themselves well. You mustn't be partial. Hear out the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone. For the judgment is God's. Remember Paul writing to Timothy and saying, I know you're young. And a presbyter, by the very word itself, are usually older men. But the Christian church is, Paul's quite capable of choosing a younger man to lead. Well, it's a bit difficult because they're used to the other system. He says, don't worry about your age. You in good in season or out of season, keep preaching the good news. You've got the gift. You know, do it. And if any case is too hard for you, bring it to me and I'll hear it, says Moses. If it gets too tough, I'll handle it for you. There's a map. That's our present 4th century AD suggested place for Mount Horeb or Sinai, right down the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. Do you got that? I've visited there. You may have visited there. It's a lovely site. We don't have the foggiest idea with anything, but that's the one they chose. Like you might have the Stations of the Cross around in the paddock around here, and you might have one tree as the first station and another tree as the second station, do you know what I mean? So we say that's where the crucifixion is. So you go over there for the 12th station or whatever it happens to be. But you're not saying that's where it happened. It's just that that's the place where you celebrate it. So this is the place where they remembered in the 4th century and celebrated and pilgrimages to remember these beautiful stories. But where was the mountain? No one has the faintest idea. And you've got no reason to know it and you'll never find out. So relax. That's where that is. We're going to see the journey. 119. Just as Yahweh our God had ordered us, we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrible wilderness that you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites until we reached Kadesh Barnea. We know where that is. That's Kadesh Barnea. Up here in the where people are more likely to be travelling. But so we're going now, that's the, verse 1, chapter 19, is the journey from here to there. And that's quite important. Deuteronomy 1, 19 to 29, they sent some spies out. So they get to here, obviously hoping to go in there. That's the quickest way to go, isn't it? And they could be there in a few weeks and be all fine, or a month or something, whatever it takes. So they send some spies in to check out how best to go in. What are they like? Have they got armed cities? Have they got walled cities? Do they have cannonballs or Kalashnikovs? What do you call those? You know, what have they got there? Or do they have, like, North Korea? What the hell have they got? You know, you better find out before you barge in. So that's what he sent the spies off for. And Moses, at the spies come back, and they say they're like giants. Oh, bloody hell, they're twice our size. We're about 3'6" or something. They're about 7 foot or whatever. And they've got this and they've got that. And, you know, there's no hope. We'd never... And so Moses says, verse 29, I say to you... So this is... I'm picking and choosing for you. Have no dread or fear of them. Yahweh your God, who goes before you, is the one who will fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt, before your very eyes, and in the wilderness where you saw how Yahweh your God carried you. That's the wilderness before they got to Sinai. Carried you. Remember the text in Exodus? I've carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Just as one carries a child, all the way you traveled till you reached this place, Sinai, Horeb. So remember all that? Look what he did. Why on earth, if you can get out of Egypt, why would you be afraid of Canaan? You know, go for it. But in spite of this, you have no trust in Yahweh your God, who goes before you on the way to seek out a place for you to camp. In fire by night and in a cloud by day. Mysterious, beautiful, to show you the route you should take. Now I hope, if I could just... See, if you're reading this at home with a little lamp shade and your dog on your lap, or however you like to do it, looking at the flowers outside that your husband has been tending for years, yes, all of that, and you're sitting there and you're doing a meditation on the scriptures and you were to read that passage, it's obvious, isn't it? You could read that for half an hour and just live with it, because it's about you and me too, isn't it? About the next step in your journey. Should you divorce him or her? Or should you apologize? Or should you have another go? Or should you... What? Life's hard. What do you do? So but you're journeying and God's brought you all this way. Sure, you know what I mean? So you think about it in the light of your life, and I think about it in the light of mine. The provincial asked me to go to Ethiopia as a missionary. And I think, great. No, I think, oh, leaving Kippax would be so hard. You know what I mean? So we've got to... That's about me and you. It's still terribly relevant, surely. Deuteronomy 1:34. But when Yahweh heard your words, your refusal, your fear, you're relying on yourself so that you won't go into the promised land that he said you got there. When Yahweh heard your words, he was wrathful, full of anger, and he swore. He didn't say bugger. Swore means he took an oath. Not one of these shall see the good land that I swore to give to your ancestors, except Caleb. Caleb was one of the spies who came back and stood up for the good side, but he was in the minority, of course. But he stood up, and so he's blessed. He shall see it because of his complete fidelity to Yahweh. He's another Noah, if you like, who can be a just person and take us out of chaos into this. Even with me, Moses says, even with me, Yahweh was angry on your account, saying, you shall not enter there. Ah, that's quite interesting. Here's the Deuteronomic writers. Everybody knows, or the legends are, or the stories are, that Moses never entered the promised land, okay? That's the tradition, that's the story, that he died on the other side. Why? it must be because God wanted it. Got the logic? God must have wanted it because Moses must have done something wrong. Because God must be punishing him. That's their logic. Doesn't work, but that's their logic, and it's all the way through. So watch it. Be careful of it. So what did he do wrong? Well, here it is. This is the explanation in the Deuteronomic writings of why Moses died in Horeb and did not himself go into the promised land. Brackets. But if you look at Numbers chapter 20, verse 12, the priest's tradition is different. The priest's tradition is that Moses, because remember God said, go and strike the rock and water will come from the rock, and he went and struck it twice. He doubted God. And that's where they give their explanation. So you've got two different opinions here, and they're both in the Bible. Neither of them are factual, but they're both trying to cope with this extraordinary fact, or memory, or tradition, or legend, or whatever. Joshua, son of Nun, your assistant, shall enter there. The tradition is that Joshua went in. In fact, the next book is about him leading them in. Encourage him. He is the one who will secure Israel's possession of it. Your children shall enter there. To them I will give it. They will take possession of it. It's the next generation. But as for you, journey back into the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. So, they're at Kadesh Barnea, shortly after leaving here, shortly, I don't know how long, month, 2 months, you know, not a long time. They get to Kadesh Barnea. According to the Deuteronomic tradition, the wandering for 40 years, they had to come down here. That's a road called the Way of the Red Sea. That's the name of the way. They had to come down here, and their years of wandering were all in this area, because they enter through there from Jordan. So this is the area of wandering. According to the priestly tradition, which we'll do when we look at the book of Exodus, if you've got enough patience to come to that too, they place the 40 years before Kadesh Barnea, because they want all the laws that are mentioned in the book of Exodus to be closely attached to Sinai. Do you see? They want it to be a kind of an overflow of the Sinai revelation. So that's where they have the tradition, and they arrive there after they've journeyed 38 or something years. So again, you've got a different tradition. All you've got to do is read them carefully and you'll see it. But if you don't read them carefully and don't notice it, you could be a fundamentalist and quote this text and say, look, that's what God said. Do you get it? Without knowing what God said in Exodus. So just watch it. That's where they're heading, by way of the Red Sea. Deuteronomy 1, 41 to 46. This is our last page before the break. They attack Canaan. When they hear the punishment that God's giving them, you're going to have to wander. They say, oh, okay, we'll do it. But it's too late. God said to do it then, and they didn't. Now they're trying to do it now, but they're doing it without authorization from God. They're doing their own thing, so they're going to fail because they haven't got God with them. This is the text. You answered me, we've sinned against Yahweh. We're ready to go up and fight, just as Yahweh our God commanded us. So all of you strapped on your battle gear, thought it easy to go up the hill country, and Yahweh said to me, say to them, don't go up and do not fight, for I am not in your midst. Otherwise you'll be defeated by your enemies. Although I told you, says Moses, you wouldn't listen. And when you returned and wept before Yahweh, Yahweh would neither heed your voice nor pay you any attention after you'd stayed at Kadesh as many days as you did. Chapter 1 hasn't done a lot, but you got it? That's the beginnings of this, and it's putting it all back there, and it is highlighting for us the importance of doing God's will. I did a wedding last week in Sydney, and I thought this was pretty smart, really. don't know what they thought of it. It was a special kind of a thing. I won't go into it now. But, I worked out how to do it. I got a tuning fork, and if you bang it on your knuckle, and there's a piano there, okay, and put it just on the board of the piano, the sounding board, so the piano, it was in A, if you need to know, and I went, boom, boom. You hear the harmony, resonance, whatever the word is. The board gives off this colossal sound. Now, it's not the origin of the sound, the board. The origin of the sound is the tuning fork. So you be the board for a minute. I'll be the board, you be the board. That's me in there. And we're listening to what's going on in here. Thoughts, feelings, inspired thoughts, whatever they might be. And you hear... Well, the important thing, which is this about, is I'm not the source of the thing, God is. We're the sounding board. So when we listen to our heart, we're actually listening for the echo or the resonance that's coming from somewhere else. A bit complicated, is it? So in other words, the source is God. So we're actually listening for an echo. We're not listening for an original thing. And that is different. It's quite a different feeling to, what do you want? What does God want me to do? Where is God asking me to go into Canaan? And just because I go in or don't go in, the key is to go in response to God, which means we're asking God to enlighten us, and we're listening for what happens when we make that prayer.